From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her memoir, Elizabeth Smart says the story we've all come to know about how she was abducted from her home in the middle of the night by a religious fanatic who sexually abused her every day. That story actually didn't begin that night, but a few days earlier at church. Smart writes about a lesson in Sunday school that said, if you give your life to service, God will direct you. But it wasn't until 2 days later, she says, when she was struggling up a mountain in the middle of the night that she began to wonder if this was what God had in mind for her life. A new documentary about Smart's ordeal premieres this weekend, so we're rebroadcasting her conversation, her story, the role of family and faith and survival. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There must have been moments after Elizabeth Smart's ordeal that she just wanted to forget the whole experience. The experience of being abducted from her bed by the religious fanatic Brian David Mitchell when she was 14, of being forced to climb through the rough scrub oak in the mountains east of her home, being bound by a cable on her leg, being raped every day. There must have been moments when she just wanted to put all of that aside. But in her memoir, Smart says all of those memories are a part of her now. And as horrifying as these stories are, she tells them in the book because she says they are the things that have moved her and shaped her into the person she is today. This month, there's a new documentary and a TV movie about her ordeal, which is giving us an opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation with Elizabeth Smart about her book called My Story. In the immediate years following her abduction, Smart says she hadn't really thought about sharing her story or writing a book.
I just always thought, this has happened to me, but I'm not going to let it control my life. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to do exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
And just as I've gone along, I've realized that I really do feel like I have an incredible opportunity to make a difference, to give something back. And I've gotten to a point in my life where I feel like I can talk about it, I can write about it, I can work with it,
yeah.
And it won't bother me, it won't haunt me. I feel like I just have this incredible opportunity to make a difference.
Yeah. So you see this as a chance for people, when they hear this story, to be given a sense of hope and also possibility. That seems an important theme in the book.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million things I'd like people to walk away with feeling, but hope is probably what I would wish for first.
Yeah.
And never giving up, just feeling like we can endure to the end. We can make it. This is not beyond our grasp. We can do it.
You know, I have to say, one of the things that makes me, I have to be honest, feel a little uneasy about this interview is the parts that are, what parts are private, what parts are public. Now, I'm going to stick to the information in the book because that's the part you write about. But it did make me wonder if you think that the public is entitled to know what happened to you. I mean, what's the private part, what's the public part? How do you decide which is which? Have you thought about that?
I've thought a lot about it. I know it's so important, and I can't stress enough how important privacy is. The best thing we can do for anyone who goes through something traumatic is respect their privacy. It's enough for us to know that they have made it home safely, and if they feel like sharing, then they'll share. But it's not up to us to pry. And for me, writing this book, I thought a lot about what I wanted to include, and initially I didn't think I'd go into deep detail, and then as I went on with the writing process, I just felt I'd be doing myself and other survivors a disservice if I tried to make light or pass up what happened.
I wonder, there are things that you keep to yourself, of course. I won't ask what they are, but there are things that you just can't share or won't share, I'm sure.
There are some things that I did not include in the book, but they didn't need to be included.
Yeah. I wonder, You say in the book that, in an odd way, your story began a few days before you were abducted on Sunday. And you tell about this lesson you had in Sunday school. I love how you tell this story about your Sunday school teacher. Seems like a charming fellow with a gray beard and white hair. And he says to you, and this is how you report it in the book, you say, he said in this lesson. Now, mind you, these are a bunch of 14-year-old kids. I'm guessing a good number of them probably weren't paying all that attention. But you happen to be, at least at this particular moment, right?
Right.
And he says this thing, and he says, if you lose your life in the service of God, he will direct you. He will help you. And you say in the book that there was this kind of intensity in his voice, and that you kind of took note of that he was really serious. What was that? What do you think was going on there?
I was so intrigued by what he had to say because I was sitting there thinking, okay, I am 14 years old. I'm in junior high. I mean, I'm second of six kids. Like, how much exactly can I give up my life? I mean, how much can God really change my life or use me? Because to me, it feels like my life is pretty stable, with just not a whole lot of room for surprise, I guess. I felt like I was going down a road, and it just seemed the road that every other 14-year-old kid was going down, and there's no way around it. So I remember sitting there thinking about it and being like, okay, well, he's sitting here promising me that my life is going to change if I basically devote it to God. How much could it possibly change? I guess I'll see. And so that's kind of what pushed me into praying and telling God, okay, I'll do what you want me to do. Tell me what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting.
Well, read this section if you would. This is that section where you go into the closet in your, the walk-in closet in your bedroom that you shared with your sister. Do you need to say anything more to set this up, or just do you want to read this?
I'll just read it. Kneeling down, I closed my eyes. I don't know how to say it, but I did the best I could. God, I'm here. I said, I'm only 14, I know I'm just a little girl, but I'll do whatever it is you want me to do. I really do want to serve you, but I'm not sure that I know how. I waited a moment, maybe I was waiting for something to happen, a vision, a revelation, some kind of sign from God, but nothing happened. So I got up and didn't think about it again, at least not until 2 days later, when Brian David Mitchell took me from my house and forced me to start climbing up the mountain in the middle of the night. Struggling up this side of the hill, breathless and terrified, a bearded man behind me and a long knife to my back with scratched arms and my silky red pajamas clinging to my legs, I couldn't help but wonder, God, is this what you had in mind? I was so confused and so afraid. I don't understand. I did what you asked me. This can't be what you have wanted. And it certainly wasn't. I know that now. Being taken captive was not part of some great eternal plan. But the confusion was overwhelming. My mind tumbled in sheer terror. This doesn't make any sense. I've never done anything wrong. And though it would take a while, the answers to my confusion eventually settled in my mind. I don't think what happened to me was something that God intended. He surely would not have wished the anguish and torment that I was about to go through upon anyone, especially upon a child. But since that time, I have learned an important lesson. Yes, God can make some good come from evil, but even He, in all His majesty, won't make the evil go away. Men are free. He won't control them. There is wickedness in this world. Which left me with this. When faced with pain and evil, we have to make a choice. We can choose to be taken by the evil, or we can try to embrace the good.
Choosing. That's an important point for you, it seems. It comes up time and time again. I mean, the moments of the trial, the question of, is Brian David Mitchell crazy? Should he take responsibility for his actions? And we'll get to some of that, but this idea of choice.
I don't know anybody who has a perfect life. I don't know anybody who hasn't had some kind of trial or hardship in their life. And maybe when hearing other people's stories, they think, well, mine's nothing. Why is it such a challenge? Why is it such a struggle for me then? But I think it's so important to realize that none of us can really compare what we go through anybody else because we're all so different. We're all raised differently. We're just all made differently. And so what's hard for me might be not so hard for someone else and vice versa. And I just want people to know that you don't have to lose your life. You don't have to carry a ball and chain around with you forever. I mean, you can be who you want to be. And that is really important for me.
You write about the moment that Brian David Mitchell seemed to kind of know that you were the one. And this goes back to November of 2001. You and your mother and your little sister, you were shopping in downtown Salt Lake City. He was on the street. He didn't have the beard. I think he was well-groomed, I think, as you recalled it in the book. He was on the street asking for money, and you mentioned that your mother gave him $5. You say you gave him a quick smile, but you would later learn he had been watching you very carefully. And I guess the question is, did you learn later, had this idea of him taking you as a wife, this weird religious concept that he had in mind, did he have that in mind, or in some way did looking at you and the strange affection he had for you, did that get him thinking? Do you know?
No, yes, I do know.
Yes, you do know.
I do know. I have listened to hours of this.
Yeah.
He was out in Salt Lake looking for a young girl to kidnap, and I just happened to be the one that, I guess, fit what he was looking for.
You say that there are a few things in this story that you're really adamant about in the book. In fact, you say in these particular parts that you want to make it very clear. There are a number of moments when you can see Elizabeth Smart just underlining this with a red pencil. And one of these is that Brian David Mitchell's life isn't something you want to understand. You say, because you point out you haven't spent even a moment of trying to figure him out or study his belief system. What do you mean by that? You just don't want to understand him.
I don't want to spend any more of my life wondering what got him to where he was to do such a terrible thing. I don't need to spend any more of my life even thinking or concerned about him.
Because it's interesting. I think some people might say, what brought him to do this? What's the religious part of it? But you're like, I'm not spending any more time.
I have no curiosity whatsoever when it comes to him. I have spent months of my life listening to him and being the victim of everything he thought and wanted. And I don't need that anymore. I've been there. I've done that. I don't need it.
It's interesting. You also describe that you know Brian David Mitchell better than any other person in the world, and that you had to understand him, even though you say crawling inside his head can be really terrifying. How do you describe the essence of the man? I think master manipulator was the thing that most or best seemed to get at him. Do you think that's it?
I'd say that's a pretty good description. He loved control. He loved power. And he loved manipulating people into doing what he wanted. He liked to find those buttons he could push to control everyone and everything around him. And what was so tragic was during the trial, I remember seeing so many witnesses get up on the stand and testify who had been in contact with him. And so many of them have had their lives destroyed by this one man. He destroyed almost every life he touched. It was tragic. That is the best word I can use to describe it. Tragic.
It's funny, you also write about how he knew just enough about religion to know the buttons to push, right, and the words to use, just enough about the vernacular. So it didn't ever mean anything in a spiritual way. It was just words that he used to kind of justify, it seemed, his life.
If there was a better way of manipulating someone else, he would have gone down that path. But as a whole, he found that, and especially at that time period, it was 2002, it was after 9/11 had happened. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of curiosity about different religions and extremism. So he was able to use that to manipulate everyone around him, to get them to stay away from him or to get them to give him money or whatever it was. That's what worked best for him. But if there was something else that would have worked better, he would have used that.
Another thing you're really clear about, of course, is that, as I said, he's not insane. Here's how you put it in the book: manipulative, antisocial, a narcissistic pedophile, but not clinically psychotic, not delusional, just an evil man. That's an important point for you, not just for the sort of legal reason of the trial. It seems like we're past that now. But that's, again, this goes back to choice, right? This idea of this is something you're saying that he had enough control of his faculties to make a choice.
Yes. And as far as the religion side of it went, he got so good at playing his role. It was easier to live in that role constantly than to snap out of it. Although there's a point in the book when I say that he can turn it on and off, which he can. And if it ever – so say you're having a conversation with him.
Yeah.
And you ask him something that he doesn't necessarily want to answer, like, how could you kidnap me? What inside you made you feel like that was okay? He could flip it on this quickly by saying, I didn't want to kidnap you. It was God's commandment, and I have to do as God commands. Now, I know that's not true. He knows that's not true, but that's just how he can manipulate people, and he can say that answer all day long and never give another answer. And that's, I mean, that's just what he did. That's just how he got away with it. That's what he told me. That's what he told his wife. That's what he, I mean, that's just how he was.
Yeah. I wonder, so what did he want from you? It wasn't some prophetic plan. It wasn't some strange delusion. He wanted sex.
Yeah, if you're coming right out and saying it. Yes. He wanted sex, and he wanted to have control. He wanted to feel powerful, and like he could do anything he wanted. And there was nothing I could do about it. I mean, that's what he wanted.
Of course, people know the story by now, how he broke into your house the night of June 5th, 2002, made his way into your bedroom at night, whispers to you, I have a knife to your neck, don't make a sound. There's another thing you're quite clear about in the book, and that is that Brian David Mitchell would have, could have killed you and others. Because I think I've heard people say, you know, he was just a coward. These were idle threats. He was just kind of a crazy guy making idle threats. You're really convinced he would have done it.
They weren't there. Nobody else was there except me, so nobody else has any right to say that. But yeah, he would have killed me. What was going to stop him? He kidnapped me. He raped me. He chained me up. He did terrible, terrible things to me. Nothing stopped him then. What would have stopped him from killing me or killing my family?
You write about this arduous trek that night up to the camp that he had established in the mountains east of your house. And you write about how during the climb it was really dark, but at some point you were able to get a glimpse of his cheeks and his eyes, you say, sort of an image of his face. And then it hit you. You remembered him because he had done some work at your house. I'm not sure if you remembered the incident in Salt Lake City, the downtown Salt Lake City. I'm not sure if that was the thing that you remembered, but you did remember him. Talk about what you said to him in those first moments. What is it that you wanted to know, or what is it that you wanted to understand? Because you're just completely confused at this point.
Well, I wanted to know what he was going to do. Why was he doing this to me? My family, I tried to help him. I wanted to know if he was just going to rape and kill me. Could he please do it here? Because I wanted my family to find my remains and know that I hadn't run away. I wanted to know if he really realized what he was doing, that if he got caught, he'd go to jail for the rest of his life. I mean, I wanted to know a lot of things. And he just would always come back to me and say, oh, well, you'll find out in due time. I'm taking you as my hostage, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. The first time you saw Wanda Barzee, I wanted to ask you about that, because this is really such a strange moment. And it kind of reflects on who Wanda Barzee was. She's dressed. So you come upon the camp. There she is. And she's dressed in this linen robe, and you describe it as, you know, you are really shocked to see her dressed like that. Here she is in this, like a campground. And then you write that she walked up to you and pulled you into a strong embrace. But you mention it wasn't an act of kindness. It wasn't an act of warmth. It was something else. Describe that, if you would.
If hugs could speak... This
hug or embrace would have said something to the effect of, "You're mine, and you'll do exactly what I say, and you won't fight it, because if you do, I'll beat you or I'll kill you or you'll be miserable. I will make you miserable." That's basically what it said.
Yeah. It was domination.
Complete.
Yeah. Here's the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, because you were clear about Brian David Mitchell, and this is something you're really adamant. You say, "I want to be clear. I never developed any kind of affection for Wanda Barzee. She was a monster, and I knew that." Reflecting back on it now, did you ever feel sympathy at all? I mean, she was incredibly cruel. There were moments when she could have helped you. I didn't ever see any moment, at least not in the story that you tell in the book, of contrition or sympathy. But were there times when you did feel sorry for her because she was where she was? I mean, how do you describe that relationship now?
I wouldn't say that I felt sympathy for her, because she could have done whatever she wanted. She could have got up and walked away. She could have left us. She could have helped me. I think the worst part about Wanda Barzee is that she was a mother. She had 6 children of her own, and yet she could sit there and watch him kidnap me and watch him rape me and watch him force me to at least make me feel like I was destroying myself. And she just didn't care. So did I feel sympathy for her? No, because she could have done whatever she wanted, and she could have helped, and she could have made a difference to me. But I look at her today, and do I feel sympathy for her a little bit today? I feel sorry for her.
Yeah.
I mean, to allow yourself to be so easily manipulated when you know what you're doing is wrong. How can you allow that?
Yeah. You've been incredibly candid about what happened to you during those 9 months. The fact that he raped you pretty much every day, sometimes more than once. At what point, Elizabeth, did you decide to be public about that? About that part, that most private part?
I don't know if it was something that I ever really decided that I would go public on. It just sort of seemed to happen, sort of seemed to come around about with the trial. And when the trial came out, and there were so many things that I had never shared before, so many facts that I was resolved just to let lie in the past. But when they did come out, when it was all done and over with, I felt like I hadn't really been able to give my side of the story. Yes, what had happened did come out, but I couldn't say what it made me feel like or what it then caused me to do. I didn't say, I mean, it was my life. I just felt like there was so much more to it than just an action that was taken, and I wanted to share that. I wanted to set the record straight. I wanted to let people know what it was really like.
You know, I was looking at the title, My Story, and I thought a lot about that, that this is mine to share. This is my story. If people, you know, and other people talk about it, you know, there are news reports, there are articles. Heaven knows. You've seen them. But it seems like this is like, I thought about the title, that this was her chance to say, this is my story to tell. Did you ever feel that way?
Yes, absolutely. That's why it's called My Story, because
yeah.
It is my story. It's not my parents. It's not my uncles. It's not anybody else's out there. This is my story in my words that I wrote. This is what happened.
Elizabeth Smart. Her memoir was published in 2013 and co-authored with Chris Stewart. It's called My Story. This Sunday and Monday, a 2-part documentary will premiere on the cable channel A&E. Then on November 18th, the channel Lifetime will premiere an original movie called I Am Elizabeth Smart. You can find details for both of those films on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Elizabeth Smart. It's been 15 years now since she was kidnapped from her home in Salt Lake City. This weekend, a new documentary about the story will premiere on A&E. In 2013, we spoke with Smart about her memoir. The book is called My Story. There's this powerful moment in the book that you write about. You write about how you believe in a God who loves, someone who comforts people. And even you say after being raped, you say you still felt that way. But then you write this. You said, I would have happily, and these are the moments that things seem to be the worst. You say, I would have happily gone to him if I could have left that place of pain. But you never once contemplated ending your own life.
No. I mean, if someone came to me and said, okay, through door number one, yeah, go to heaven, meet your maker, meet God, and door number two, keep on going. You don't know what's going to happen, but just keep on trying. Oh, I would have chosen door number one, no question. But I am not a violent person. I mean, when I see roadkill on the side of the road, I feel bad.
Yeah.
Maybe it's kind of pathetic, but I see it and then I think of my little dog at home and I'm like, oh, that could be my dog. But I'm just not a violent person. And the thought of ending my own life, just, I couldn't do that.
You mean physically couldn't do it? Or you thought, did you ever think God would understand even if I could?
No, physically I couldn't do it.
Yeah. That's interesting. You write at one point, this was early in the morning of that first day, you said something changed inside you. You put it this way. You said, after I had been raped and brutalized, there was something new inside my soul. What do you mean?
Well, I had felt like when I was being raped, I had felt like I was crushed, like nobody could really accept me back ever again. Like I should just give up right now because my life was over. But that passed. And then I realized that maybe people wouldn't accept me back. Maybe I would never be a normal human being ever again. But my family, they'd still love me. They'd still be there for me. And because of that, I realized I had something worth living for, worth surviving for. And that's really when I made the decision, when I made the resolve that I would do whatever it took. Somehow I'd survive. Somehow I'd get home. And that's really how I made every decision afterwards. I'd sit down and I'd think, okay, if I do this, will I survive? If I don't do this, will I survive? What's going to happen? What are the consequences? And that's how I moved forward.
You know, there's this, I can see the 14-year-old brain working when there's this thing you write about in the book where you said, look, I'm 14, he's maybe 50, she's whatever, 60, whatever. So even if I am still with these guys, I will outlive them.
Yeah, I did get to a point of thinking that because I was so well hidden. I mean, this campsite is remote. On paper, it might not look that far, but holy cow, if you hike it, it is not easy. You might as well be out in the middle of nowhere because it is that difficult to get to. It is that well hidden. So we were so well hidden. I mean, here he was trying to dig out an underground house behind the tent so that we could stay there forever. And I was being cabled up. He'd gone through this fake marriage process. I mean, just everything that he had done was showing me that I was in this for a long time. I was going to be in this for who knew how long. And so as I sat there thinking about how long is this going to be, one comfort I could take was, well, you know, they are quite a bit older than me. I could outlive them. That might be the best way for me to get home.
3 days into this experience, you write about how you were, you'd been hearing these airplanes. There had been the sound of helicopters in particular. But on this particular day, you hear a voice in the distance. I want to have you read a section here. Talk about this moment, first of all, because you must have wondered. I mean, as you heard the planes overhead, you thought, maybe that's for me, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I did wonder if that was for me because it seemed like there was a lot more activity in the area than usual. Not that I charted planes or kept track of it, but, you know, as a little kid, you look outside when you hear a big loud vibration in the air, and it just seemed to be so much more than usual. And so I did wonder if it was people looking for me.
The voice went away, right?
Yes.
I mean, you have all the there's this expectation built up. Oh, someone has found me. Someone's there. They're going to. But then there's this fear about what Brian David Mitchell was going to do, blah, blah, blah. But then at this moment here in this section, it's when you realize that maybe the voice is gone. Read this section, if you would.
Yes. I was being torn apart inside. My heart beat with both terrible excitement and utter fear. Someone was looking for me. Someone was very near, calling my name. I might be rescued. He might find me. But if he did, would Mitchell kill him? If I screamed, the man might hear me. He might try to climb up the side of the mountain, but would he find me? I could picture Mitchell, this crazy man, jumping out from behind a tree and slitting his throat. My uncle would be dead. I would still be captured. Nothing would really change. Then would Mitchell kill me too? Would he move me somewhere else, somewhere worse, somewhere more dangerous, someplace much farther away from my family and my home? I remembered how hard it had been to climb the mountain. There had been times when we had been forced to crawl on our hands and knees. It might take, what, an hour for my uncle, if it was my uncle, to climb up the mountain to the camp. Plenty of time for Mitchell to kill me. Plenty of time to get ready to attack whoever came into the camp. For a moment, a fantasy flashed into my mind, the dream of a desperate little girl. I imagined lots of men, maybe 20, maybe more. They knew where the camp was without me screaming. They surrounded the camp. There was nothing Mitchell could do. He couldn't hurt me. He couldn't attack them all. He might turn to me in anger, but he would know that it hadn't been my fault, that they had found me. He couldn't blame me. I had done everything he had told me to do, but the man had found me anyway. I wanted it so badly that I could hardly breathe. I wanted to be away from there. I wanted to be away from him. I wanted to go home. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to be safe and not hurt anymore. But I knew it wasn't real. There was no group of men. They weren't going to surround us. There was only one man, and Mitchell was going to kill him if he came into the camp. I glanced at Barzee. Her face was mean and hard. Mitchell moved closer to me. His eyes were as deadly as the steel of his knife. "You will die here," his eyes seemed to say. "You and whoever is down there in the canyon. There's no way this ends well if he starts climbing toward our camp." My heart fell on my stomach. I wasn't just brokenhearted. I was shattered, simply shattered. I had lost my only chance. I started shaking. My knees turned to rubber. My throat grew so tight I couldn't breathe. The bitter disappointment seemed to crush my soul. We waited, all of us listening intently. The voice called again a time or two, but then faded. A long time passed. We didn't move. The voice was never heard again. That night, I cried myself to sleep again. And though I didn't know it, 4 or 5 miles to the west, my mother cried herself to sleep as well.
You're right about, it's interesting, kind of there was a routine. And one of the things that really comes out that I hadn't really thought about is how much boredom played, how bored you were. That seemed like almost one of the worst, well, no, but a really bad thing, a terrible thing.
No, I've wondered which is worse, listening to Mitchell talk nonstop about himself or being raped. It's a good question. It was pretty bad.
Constant. Were there any ordinary conversations, or was it just him holding forth and going on and on and on and on?
It was mostly him going forth and on and on and on. I mean, if I ever tried to bring up some kind of topic, conversation, it would always come back to him and how smart he was and how he knew so much about everything and just how he'd been calling and he'd been chosen and I should be thanking him, I should be grateful, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the boredom and the heat and the thirst. I mean, all of those elements, I don't think people had thought that much about, and really until you started to tell the story.
It was pretty bad. It was really bad. Yeah, my days consisted of being bored, being hungry and thirsty, and ultimately being raped.
I know you've talked about this, but I did want to address one of the questions. Of course, this comes up all the time for you. Why didn't she cry out when she had the opportunity later, wandering around the city, that veil on her face? And I wanted to ask you this first, not why you didn't, but what do you make of that question at all? As if people are somehow suspicious or wondering if you were brainwashed, or what do you think people ask that question in the first place?
Because they've never been in a situation like that themselves. And so they can only go off what they've seen in media and movies. I mean, what movie does the person not yell or not scream out or not try to run away? I mean, that's just how it is portrayed all the time. But to actually be in that situation is something altogether different. I mean, to have the knowledge of what had happened to me up until that point and how terrible it had been, and then being told that I would be killed and my family would be killed, that's all I had to believe. That's all I had to go off of. And to me, my family is everything, and I would do anything for them. And so the thought of someone hurting my family because of something I did, I couldn't stand that. I couldn't stand the thought of that happening. I mean, I have been both physically chained up, and I have had chains made of words. And I can tell you, words are so much stronger than physical chains.
Yeah, that's how you put it in the book. You said that you, at some point, you reached a point where you were being held captive by Mitchell's words. And you mentioned this moment when you had been at the end of this cable forever, and you wanted to be free from it. And you say in the book, looking back on it, there was this moment when he lets you get off of it. But you say that may have been the beginning of your subjection to Brian David Mitchell, in the sense that he no longer needed the cable, right?
Right. The cable was almost a representation of my freedom,
yeah,
in a very twisted way. And when he took it off, it's not that I never tried to escape. I did try, but it was at great personal cost. And it was after that that I knew he didn't need a cable. I knew that he could keep me there just by what he said. And it's not because I wanted to stay. It's not because I liked him or had sympathy for him or empathy. It's not because I didn't want to go home, because I did. More than anything, I wanted to be back with my family. But the thought of my little sister being hurt, especially after she'd seen me kidnapped from my own bed, or my baby brother, who might not even hardly remember me at that point in time, being murdered, I couldn't stand that.
This thing that you write, I found to be almost the most sad thing in the book. You say the reason you didn't cry out comes down to fear and humiliation. But then you say, but also the feeling that you had gone too far to be saved. That was another element of it. What do you mean?
It was petrifying. It was so scary. I was so scared. And just the feeling of, what if someone walked into camp that's not my family, and what if they did see me and they realized who I was, but they saw what I had turned into, how I had turned into this sexual object, this filthy nothing. What if they turned around and walked away because they thought, well, she's not worth saving? That was scary. That scared me. What if it was too far to be rescued?
Elizabeth Smart, her memoir is called My Story. On Sunday and Monday, there's a two-part documentary called Elizabeth Smart Autobiography, which will premiere on A&E. Then on November 18th, Lifetime is premiering a fictional account called I Am Elizabeth Smart. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and we've just started a series at Radio West Films where we break down one moment from a performance or a piece of art, one moment that is brilliant or just difficult to pull off, but if they get it right, that one moment makes all the difference. We're beginning with a piece of choreography for Ballet West's new production of Carmina Burana. It comes toward the end of the production. It's beautiful, magical, but also really risky. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation recorded in 2013 with Elizabeth Smart. We were talking about her memoir called My Story. So one of the things you had talked about earlier, and I think this is interesting, you talked about in those days after 9/11, there was such this, you know, sensitivity about people's beliefs and about their religion. And this seems to be in some way how it was so, I guess, maybe easy isn't the right word, but it was fairly easy to hide you in plain sight. You know, people are looking for Elizabeth Smart, and there she is in a veil walking around. I mean, that was really amazing that people – but here's how you put it. You talked about how did you say it? You said that it created distance. That was interesting.
It was not uncommon to be walking down a street and someone would be walking towards us, and when they'd see us, they'd stop and they'd cross the street and they'd walk along the opposite side of the street, and then once they'd passed us, they'd cross back over and go on. Or it wasn't uncommon to hear people yell stick their heads out of their car window and just yell, "Osama" or "Bin Laden." Mm. I mean, just it was not uncommon. It happened all the time. I mean, We looked different. We looked scary. We looked like we had no business being where we were.
The story that, of course, we've all come to know now, of course, is this day in March when you made your way back from California, this really brutal journey. It's a long section of the book. That's remarkable, too, of course. Like, talk about hunger. Talk about thirst. That's another extraordinary part of the story. But of course, the part that we all love is the part where you're walking down State Street on 106th South. As you say in the book, the plan was to take another bus downtown and then head back up to the camp. And you didn't know once you got back up into that horrible camp whether you were going to stay there. And then there's this sad part, too, where you say you didn't see the posters of yourself anymore.
I remember we were walking outside of a Walmart after we had just been inside getting stuff for our stay up at the hidden camp, and on in the entryway of Walmart there was this big billboard and it had pictures of like the missing children, and I remember I didn't have long to look at it, so my picture may have been up there, but I didn't see it. And I remember just looking and feeling so desperate, thinking, they've stopped looking for me. They've stopped. What do they think's happened to me? How could they stop looking for me? And I remember Mitchell just grabbing hold of me and saying, "You're making a scene. Come on, get out of here." And I remember walking out and just feeling so brokenhearted that I wasn't cared about anymore, that I'd been given up on.
And then a police car arrives.
Yeah.
And then another one.
And another one. Yeah, we were surrounded by police cars, and I don't remember how many now. It felt like tons.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, it may have only been four. I don't know.
Now, let me ask you this, Elizabeth. So these police cars are here. There's another part of the story that we didn't get to, but, you know, it's in the downtown Salt Lake City library when a homicide detective comes up and starts to question for 15 minutes Brian David Mitchell. And he's able to, in his sort of slimy, gracious, as you put it, gracious, you know, way, talk the guy out of it. But so here comes this moment again. I mean, this isn't the first time this has happened. So these police cars are surrounding you. What's going on in your mind that this could happen again?
Oh, basically every emotion in the spectrum. Yeah. Pure confusion. I mean, on one hand, I was so hopeful because it wasn't just one police officer. It was a whole bunch of police officers. On the other hand, I was so scared because I'd seen him look at other police officers directly in the eyes without flinching, just calm and cool as you please, and say, "This is my daughter. How dare you question me? I'm offended. We are trying to practice our religion, and you're persecuting us." And I just watched him get away with that so many times. I mean, how could he do it again? I don't even have words to describe really what it was like.
Yeah. But then it happened. They asked you.
Yes.
Your name.
They separated me from my captors because they realized that I was too scared. I couldn't say anything with them there. And yeah, they first started to ask me if I was Elizabeth Smart, and I kept denying it because I was so scared.
Yeah.
And I had been so threatened. But finally, one of the officers looked at me and said, "Well, if you're Elizabeth Smart, don't you know that your family loves you so much and they miss you so much and they've never given up on you once during the entire 9 months? Don't you want to go home to them?" And it was at that point that I was like, "Yes, I don't care. I don't care about anything else. I just want to go home. Please take me away." I mean, that was just the feeling. And that's what really allowed me to finally admit that I was Elizabeth.
Yeah. That's Officer Cazeta. Don't you love that guy?
Yeah.
So do we. That was an amazing moment, I have to say. I want to ask you about, in the book, you write about there are a lot of people who wonder how you're able to work through this terrible experience without any professional therapy or any professional counseling. And basically what you say is, look, everyone has to create their own pathway to their recovery, and professional therapy is fine for some people. But the thing you found was therapy riding a horse.
Yes. I've always loved horses. I've always loved to ride. As a little girl, I used to go out with my grandpa, and he would just go riding, and as soon as we'd get back from a ride, I'd say, "Let's go again, Grandpa." And I think he'd be like, "Oh, please, please stop." But
no, he used to say, "Ride more, talk less."
Yes, yes. That was his kind of whatever you were doing in the moment. That was kind of his, I guess, mantra. If we were eating dinner, it was eat more, talk less,
right,
do
right.
more, talk less. That was just him.
What was it about horses? Because you write about how you've got to pay attention to a horse. You've got to focus a horse. You've got to take care of a horse. And did that just sort of make you in some way forget or focus on something else?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, it just was such a, I mean, just getting away from everything, from like my life and who I was and how I was perceived by everyone else and being able to really step outside of all that and get into nature with this incredible animal that doesn't care who you are, doesn't care what you've been through or what you've done in your life. A horse is going to, I mean, it doesn't. He doesn't care if you're, you know, Bill Gates, Donald Trump, or, you know, just the girl next door. Doesn't care. And they're going to be a pretty good reflection of the kind of person you are, how you treat that horse, whether you take care of it, how you ride it. They're going to reflect. They're going to mirror who you are. And so that helped me. I mean, going out with this animal that doesn't care who I am but can respect me as long as I respect him or her, that was very great to me. And to be able to step away from my life and sort of look at the bigger picture and not just my momentary problem and say, okay, this is hard, but realistically speaking, say it was today, say I went out riding today and I stepped away from my life and I looked at it and I say, okay, most of my life has been pretty great. I mean, really only 9 months of it was terrible. The rest of the time, I've been surrounded by people who love me, people who care about me, people who want what's best for me. I've been following my goals and my dreams and things that are important to me. And yeah, I don't always succeed. Yes, I fall down. I have bad days. I mean, I'm not perfect, but
overall, 9 months out of, you know, 12 times 26, whatever that is, that's pretty good odds. Like, I have every reason to be grateful. I have every reason to appreciate where I am in my life and for everything that's been done for me.
Let me ask you this finally. Do you expect there will come a time when you won't be, I don't know, not defined by this experience, but maybe even identified with it? Or does that even matter?
It doesn't really matter to me. People who know me and who are my friends and I have a relationship with, they know that I'm more than a kidnapping story. I mean, they know me. They make fun of me. Anytime they think my head gets too big, they have no problems deflating it. And if other people view me that way, then, I mean, there's nothing I can really do about it. It's just the way things are, and I might as well just move forward and be happy that I'm here.
That's Elizabeth Smart. Her memoir is called My Story. It was co-written with Chris Stewart. On Sunday, A&E will premiere a two-part documentary called Elizabeth Smart Autobiography. It's a cross-network event with a Lifetime movie called I Am Elizabeth Smart. That will air November 18th. You can get details of all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.